At one point, we mistakenly put him somewhere else in the program, and we learned to fix that in a hurry. And so we preserved this tradition of ending the conference at the summit. And so Carver Mead is when the people come in. More adjectives. When the people leave the bar, they can get some real effervescence and what? A real high, right. Okay, well, thank you. That's, and I hope you all, we plan next year a real gala anniversary, 10th, and it's the, Brett Swanson figured out all the anniversaries that would be celebrated next year. It was going to be the 10th year of the GTR, the 10th year of the company, the 10th year of Telecosm, the 10th year of the web, the 10th year of, what were the, Oh, yeah, the downside was the 10th anniversary of the 96 Telecom Act, but we can't have, we don't need to celebrate that, I don't think. But we certainly, the leading thing we celebrate is Carver Mead, who made all this possible, and all my thinking about the telecosm and the microcosm and the wisdom of that takes science to a really transcendent level. And probably, yeah, it's almost certainly, it's been here for the last 8 years. We did have 1 year in Palm Springs when we started out before we discovered this place. Yeah, but we had the real conference earlier when Carver and I and Dick Trudenick, I think, were the three people who gathered at Bull Whackers on September 12th and 11th, I guess. Or was it the 12th? I guess it was the 11th that we gathered here for the, at least the Rump conference, and then we did have we did do it in San Francisco because they were skiing here and couldn't have us. Anyway, Carver, thank you. And over.
Thanks, George. Good to be back. Before we talk about the future, let's look back a little bit. Where did we come from in electronics? The first recognizable electronics that any of us would sort of dignify with the name started with the vacuum tube. It was just over 100 years ago, and Thomas Edison was making light bulbs, as he was wont to do. And he noticed that some of his light bulbs got, after they'd been illuminated for a while, they got a little sort of dark film of gunk on the inside of the bulb. He'd make the bulb by having a thin filament of wire or carbon fiber or something, and he experimented with many different kinds. And then he would evacuate the bulb and seal it off by melting the glass. And then he would burn them and see how long they'd go and how much light they'd give and so forth. And he noticed that they would they'd get this dark film on the inside of the bulb after they had been illuminated for a while. So being an experimenter, Edison put in a little plate of metal which was sealed in through the glass, just like the two electrodes that hooked up to the filament, so you could run current through the filament and get it to light up, just like the light bulbs we go down to the store and buy today. So he put a third seal through the glass and put a little plate in there. And even with the crude instruments he had available in those days, he found that if he applied a positive voltage to that little plate, there would be a very small current which would come out, which went away if he didn't heat the filament. But if he heated the filament, there would be this current. It didn't happen if you made the little plate negative, but it did happen if you made the little plate positive. And he reasoned that there were some kind of negative charges that were coming from the filament over to the plate. That was the thing that was at that time called the Edison effect, later became the thermoelectric effect, and was soon hooked up with the electron theory, which was getting bandied about along about that time. And what was happening, as it goes, is heat up that filament that excites the electrons that are inside that wire, and some of them boil out. And they have negative charges associated with them, so if you make the little plate positive, the electrons are attracted over there, and that makes a little current. Well, that was a new effect. That's kind of neat. It wasn't long before the inventors got to work. It wasn't Edison this time. It was Lee DeForest who said, hey, what if I could control that current? So DeForest put a little piece of screen wire in between the filament and this plate. Called it the grid. Different grid. And he noticed that if he had a positive voltage on the plate, and he changed the voltage on the grid, you could change the current that went to the plate. That was the first vacuum tube. Vacuum tubes got better and better as time went on. And in fact, I did brought up on vacuum tubes, did all my original electronic stuff on vacuum tubes. They reached a very high art form, as you heard from Tom Lee. There were very special purpose vacuum tubes made during World War II. Still, most of the radio transmitters in the United States run on vacuum tubes. A lot of satellites have vacuum tubes in. So, and as a matter of fact, until very recently, the production of vacuum tubes may even still be true. I think probably it's down a little now, but the production of vacuum tubes was larger than ever in its history because of all cathode ray tubes that were used in television sets. Now we're getting slightly different technology for that, but you can still go down to Circuit City and buy a pretty good size screen TV with a vacuum tube in it. Well, the vacuum tube was not an ideal device. It, you had to heat up this filament. It took a lot of power to do that. And the filament was very fragile, and it would burn out after a while, so you were constantly going around looking at the vacuum tubes and pulling out the one that didn't glow and putting in a new one. So that was a little bit awkward. The reliability was less than you'd really like. And they also had less than ideal electronic properties. You're boiling these electrons out of the filament, and each one has a little electronic charge on it, and they go over, and when they run into the plate, they make what's called shock noise. Think of it as when you have rain on the roof. It's that noise that every time a little drop of water hits the roof, you get a little impulse of sound. And no matter how hard it rains, the harder it rains, the louder the sound gets. Now, the sound goes like the square root of the number of water drops that hit the roof, and the total amount of water goes linearly with the number of water drops. So the signal to noise, if you like, the amount of water per unit noise, is going up but it's going up like the square root of the amount of water. So the more current that flows in the vacuum tube, the more raindrops fall on the roof, the louder the noise. That's an awkward property, but it's a property that goes with these little discrete charges going across and crashing into this plate. Well, people had dreamed about a solid-state device that would do the same kind of thing. What was great about the vacuum tube is you could apply a voltage to an electrode, which didn't basically take any current, and you could control the flow of current to some other electron. So it had what we now call a transconductor. You change the voltage here, it changes the current over there. And that was the basis of making amplifiers, which was the first generation of electronics, first audio amplifiers, and then radio frequency amplifiers, radio frequency oscillators, radio sets, all the way to radar and computers, all made with vacuum tubes. The first four or five computers I used were made with vacuum tubes. People had dreamed about making solid-state equivalent of the vacuum tube. Guy with an Emerillion cell in the late 20s, early 30s, had dabbled with it. His first device, he took a layer of cadmium sulfide and he put a metal strip across it. And he reasoned that if he changed the potential on the metal strip, he could scare the electrons out of the cadmium sulfide and there would be less current. That device never worked for detailed reasons. He picked the wrong semiconductor. It was the reason I know about it is I reinvented that device in the 60s. It was what we called in those days the Schottky barrier gate field effect transistor. That's way too long a name for anything. Then it got called a MESFET. Now it's called the HEMT because they make it out of very fancy nanomaterials. And those devices, in fact, were invented conceptually by Lilienfeld. When Lilienfeld found out that he was having trouble with the cadmium sulfide, there were ions in the cadmium sulfide that would move around and they would null out all of his electric field that he would have normally got from the plate that he put down. He put a thin insulating layer in there, and he patented that one too. So he patented the MESFET late 20s, and he patented the MOSFET. That's an insulated gate field effect transistor. That's what we call them. And of course, that was too long a name, so then it became MOSFET. The transistors we all use today, the transistors that they're, as Gordon Moore says, that for every amp has to carry around 1,000 transistors on his back, and every amp in the world, that's how many transistors there are out there. Gordon feels really bad for the amp. So Lilienfeld, in fact, invented both of the field effect transistors that are used today. Never get one to work. Then the first transistor that actually did work was an accident. When I was a kid, I made a thing called a crystal set. Anybody here remember crystal sets? Yeah, how about that? That's great. You got these little crystals that were embedded in some kind of lead or something. And you take a little cat's whisker, which you made up out of the finest wire you could get from wherever you could scrounge. And if you poked around on the crystal, you could find a sensitive spot. And if you hooked that up to a coil and a capacitor, which was a tuned circuit, you could tune in a radio station if it was close enough. You hooked the whole thing up to your earphones, and you had to be pretty close to the radio station. But that was the first solid-state rectifier. And then those got improved and improved and improved. And during World War II, those those were the standard rectifiers that were used in radar. There's still zillions of them sold, and they're the most, by far the largest volume discrete component that's made. And the Bell Lab had read Lilienfeld's patent, Shockley in particular, and he was determined they were going to make those devices. Well, the trouble with the guys at Bell is they're pretty independent. They wouldn't always do just what Shockley said. So Barnard and Bratton had this idea that there was something special going on these point contact rectifiers, where that little wire came down against the semiconductor. There was some special little thing, because it would carry current one way and not the other way. That's what made it a rectifier. So what was it that caused that current to be able to go one way and not the other way? Not so trivial. They said, well, how would you figure it out? It's too little to... So what they did is they made another little wire, and they got a micro manipulator, and they moved it in, and they were going to map out the electric field to see, you know, how the influence was distributed on the semiconductor. And then they noticed something really strange, that when they put that little wire down there to measure the voltage, the current went crazy to the other wire. That sounds interesting. So that was the first transistor. It was a total accident. Shockley was livid. That wasn't something he'd invented. Well, soon Shockley came up with a theory and, in fact, gave us essentially the view that survives today of semiconductor electronics. I don't want to take anything away from Shockley. He was a difficult personality, but he really did give us the view that we still have today of how semiconductors work and how transistors work, including the field effect transistors that we use today. Now, so how does that transistor work? Well, actually, a lot like a vacuum tube. It has three regions. It has a region on one side, which has a lot of electrons in it, a region on the other side, which has a lot of electrons in it, and a region in the middle, which doesn't have it. But it's hooked up in such a way, and it depends on the detail of the transistor exactly how that way is, but they all work the same in the sense that that reason that region in the middle doesn't have electrons in it is that there's an energy barrier. In other words, it takes energy to take an electron out of the region here and get it into this region in the middle. Well, when I said there weren't any electrons, that was too strong a statement, because the electrons over here are in thermal equilibrium. This time, you don't have to heat them up. They're already heated up by room temperature. So they're thermally distributed. And if you lower the barrier, you get more electrons. You get exponentially more electrons. It's a Boltzmann distribution and well-known. So as you move the energy barrier down by making the thing in the middle, which is either called the base or the gate or another one. Anyway, they've named it different things. It was like the British system of units. You had to have a different unit for everything you were measuring. You know, it was like that for a while on semiconductors. Anyway, when you put a positive voltage on this middle electrode, whatever you call it, the base or the gate or whatever, you lower the energy barrier and more electrons can get over. So now we've done the thing just like the vacuum tube, where you can control the flow from one region to another by hooking up a potential to a third thing in between. So all it is very compact, and you don't have to heat up the filament because room temperature is just fine, thank you. And you can control the flow of electrons, runs on lower voltages. And it was seen even early on that although the first ones were very, very slow, they were enormously slow compared to the vacuum tube. But the vacuum tube was highly evolved, and this new semiconductor stuff was just beginning. So everybody said it's small, the electrons don't have to go very far, so potentially it ought to be fast. Well, sure enough, people got busy. They started making things smaller, figuring out how the physics worked, figuring out what limited the speed, and one thing led to another, to another, to another, and then you got first wave of companies that did that were the vacuum tube companies, RCA, GE, those guys. Next wave of companies were Fairchild, Texas Instruments, those guys. Next wave of guys doing that, Intel, so forth. Well, first transistor happened in 47, 48 time frame. It was in the 50s that things really started moving. That was 50 years ago. 40 years ago that Gordon Moore said, you know, we keep getting better at this. And if a little bit is good, then more is better because everybody knows that. And so it's going to keep getting better and better. And that was true. So two things happened. One was the transistors got better. The other thing was we started putting more and more of them on a single piece of silicon. And this has been bandied about enough, I don't have to tell you all that. But you look at the transistor itself, and it's just a baby vacuum tube. It has electrons that are thermally excited into a region where they normally wouldn't go. And then by changing the potential in that middle region, you change how many of the electrons can get across. That hasn't changed since 1905. Now that's a very long time to be operating on one physical principle. So, what's going on here? Is there any problem with that? Well, the problem is the one I mentioned before. The electrons go across. Each one carries an electronic charge, and they crash into the region on the other side, and they make this noise by doing that. So that means that you can't do anything perfectly with them. So if you're going to make amplifiers, you have to be very careful about the way you do all that. You have to use lots and lots of electrons because of this thing with the rain on the roof. You'd like it to be as close to a steady stream of water as you can get. You can't get that because there are all these little tiny electrons carrying charges. So you always have this noise. But the signal goes like linearly with the number of water drops, and the noise goes like the square root. So if I go from 100 electrons to 10,000 electrons, I get a factor of 10 in signal-to-noise ratio. A tough way to get signal-to-noise ratio. And if you go down to smaller and smaller numbers of electrons, then the statistics become even worse. And so then you'd find it necessary to go and do something to restore the signal. So all of our digital logic that we have today basically restores the signal after every logic operation. It's just what you do when you're dealing with components that have this much variability. And that's electronics. That's the way it works. We've had a theory of noise that started with Nyquist and those guys back in the early Bell Labs. Anything at finite temperature has noise, and that noise has to do with the fact that you're joggling around the number of electrons, and the number of the electrons crash into whatever they're doing, and they make noise. Well, it's kind of strange that you could have a field like this that develops a whole point of view. It operates in a way that's just all self-consistent with everything that's going on. And it don't bother to look anywhere else. It turned out exactly in parallel with all this development. Started in 1908. There was a guy in Leiden in Holland by the name of Kamerling Onnes, a very proper Dutch physicist, who was in the lead in terms of liquefying the permanent gases. Michael Faraday had liquefied all but the six or eight permanent gases, but there were these permanent gases. And gradually, people got better and better at cooling them down and putting them under pressure and doing all the shenanigans to get them to liquefy. And they liquefied oxygen and they liquefied nitrogen and then they liquefied hydrogen. Wow, that was down at 20 degrees absolute. But helium was really resistant. It was really resistant. And there were people who thought it would never be liquefied. Well, Kamerling Onnes just built a big lab, and he built a big liquefier with lots and lots of stages, and he thought carefully about how you did this, and he liquefied helium in 1908. So he had at his disposal a bath of liquid with which he could cool things down to like 4 degrees absolute. And everybody else was stuck up 20 degrees with liquid hydrogen. Besides, liquid hydrogen has an awful lot of flammable stuff free in it, volume, and it's not really the safest stuff to work with. But they did. So, of course, when you have a technology like that, the immediate thing is that's an ideal environment with which to investigate the properties of things that are that cold. And one of the things people had noticed as they were able to get to lower and lower temperatures was that the resistance of metals, the resistance to flow of current, that is, if you get electrons to flow through the metals, you had to put a voltage that kind of drifted the electrons along because they were being thermally joggled, and every time they got thermally joggled, they'd lose energy, and you have to give them the energy again to get them moving again. So that was the way resistance came about. So it was pretty clear to everyone that, and in fact a lot of people had observed, that if you took very pure metals, that their resistance went sort of close to linearly with absolute temperature. By the time they're at 20 degrees, room temperature is 300 degrees, so they'd gone over a 10-to-1 range, more or less. And so you had a pretty good idea this was going on. And it wasn't perfect, and they argued over whether it curved this way or that way, and there were all these arguments. But basically, it was clear to everyone that the thermal agitation was getting in the way of the electrons and made them lose their energy as they went along, and then you had to replenish the energy by putting a voltage along it, and that's what made the resistance of the wire. And then there are arguments, well, if you went all the way to absolute zero, would the resistance vanish, or would the wire become an insulator, or what would happen? And there were theories both ways, and there were all kinds of things. But nobody, of course, predicted what really happened. What really happened was Kamerling Onnes's people were dutifully going through measuring the resistance of these wires at different temperatures by putting different pressures on the helium and this and that. It was laborious. They'd work late in the night because they only made helium on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and so then you had to work like crazy to use the helium you had and blah, blah, blah. So it was one of these things. Who in the world needs to just plow all these points, and argue about is it curving a little this way or curving a little that way? Well, one night there was one of our grad students there, late at night, working away and making the temperature a little lower and recording the resistance in it. And the experiment quit working. The voltage went to zero, so obviously there's something wrong. So he pulled up all the connections and everything. And finally he thought, well, maybe if I just raise the temperature up and do it again. Raise the temperature a little bit, came back again. Well, this was interesting. Here was a very small change in temperature, and you get the resistance going from something that's quite measurable to something that's absolutely not measurable. Wow, that's pretty interesting. Well, Onus was smart enough to realize that this wasn't just a fluke. This was something fundamental. And nobody knew what quite. And nobody knew if it was really zero resistance or if it was just a factor of 10,000, which is all they could measure. So he started doing all kinds of measurements. That happened in 1911 on the observation of superconductivity. And then, of course, World War I came along, and it disrupted all research everywhere in the world, particularly in places like Holland, which are sort of in the middle of everything. And it was amazing. It took till in the 30s when people took very seriously the question, did the resistance really go to zero? I mean, it went down to where they couldn't measure it on their meters anymore, but they didn't have very good meters either. So how would you tell? How would you tell if it really went to zero? What would you do? I mean, you could make better and better meters, but that you could make forever. And already, metals are pretty good conductors already, so already you're talking about measuring microvolts. So it's not so simple to make things instead of 4 orders of magnitude better, you'd have to have 6 orders of magnitude. What'd you do? What would you do? You're faced with it. Why did it take until the 30s for this question to get answered? It wasn't a trivial instrumentation problem. I thought somebody had an idea here. Yeah. That would be if there was really zero, if you ever got it started in a ring, it ought to just keep going around. And then how would you know? Yeah, if it were going around, this after all, a loop like that is an inductor. And so current going around makes a magnetic field, and you can measure that without interfering with the current. So it turns out that even before World War I, Kamerling Onnes had noticed that he could keep a current in a loop like that for 2 or 3 hours. But nobody had tried to do it for days or weeks or months, which is what you'd want to do. You'd want to just keep liquid helium on there and make sure that it kept going. It was in the 30s. They finally did convincing enough experiments that the current just wasn't going down. It just stayed there. Now that experiment could have been done perfectly well before World War I. It could have been done within weeks of the discovery of superconductivity. Why wasn't it? Well, conceptually, here's a metal which is at finite temperature. It's a low temperature. It's 1% of room temperature or something. But it's still a finite temperature. So the electrons are still jostled around by the random thermal fluctuations. So it can't possibly be that they don't have system. They're the same electrons. They get jostled the same way. Can't possibly go to really zero. Onis didn't think it was zero. He thought there was some resistant, residual resistance, he called it. He just couldn't measure it. So, of course, you don't look for something that... that was not high on his radar. It wasn't until about 1940, it was just after World War II, that Fritz London was thinking about this. And he said something, well, a number of people had speculated, but Fritz said something really, really important. He said, this has to be a quantum effect. And if it is, it's caused by the fact that the electrons go into some kind of state where they make a macroscopic quantum system. A system where up to that point, everybody had said, oh, the quantum things are the small things. It shows itself in atoms and things. But the more electrons you get, or the more atoms you get, or whatever, the quantum thing reaches a classical limit, and that was Bohr's correspondence principle. It corresponds to classical mechanics once you get enough of these things, whatever they are. Well, here was a phenomenon that you had lots and lots of things. You had 10 to the 24th or 10 to the 25th or 10 to the 26th electrons. And they made one great big quantum thing. So in Fritz's mind, that had to be because the wave function that describes this matter wave has to go around and match up with itself. So it could match up with itself just by having the same phase all around, or it could have a phase which went by one cycle, or two cycles, or three cycles. So the magnetic flux in one of these rings ought to be quantized. It ought to be something that had one unit, or 2 units, or 3 units, corresponding to whether the twist is one cycle, or two cycles, or three cycles as you go around the loop. And he said this in publication, I think, 49. It was 1964 when a guy from JPL went and actually measured it. It wasn't the guy from JPL. It was Bill Fairbanks at Stanford. From Stanford. And Bill came and gave a talk at Caltech shortly after he'd done that, and that was 61 when Bill Fairbanks did that. Was done independently by a group in Germany, published in the same issue of the PhysRev Letters. That was back when you could actually get important physics published in the PhysRev Letters. I can't do that anymore. I was in the audience when Bill Fairbanks gave that talk, and I was absolutely dumbfounded. I had not known about Fritz London's prediction, and that's what led me in 61 to start thinking on the line of thought that ended up in this little green book. And you can think of this little green book as the first half of a book on how what the microcosm is going to be like when it grows up. George talks about how you go deeper and deeper into the microcosm. And that's really what I want to talk about tonight. And it's very, very clear that we have in the superconductor sort of a prototype system for what the microcosm can be like when we figure out thinking about it that leads us to invent things. Now, we've had two blind spots. The first one I mentioned, and nobody even said anything about it, and that is, here are these little electrons, these little bullets carrying electric charge, and they crash into the plate, and they make noise, and so forth. But those same electrons, when they're in this loop, don't make any noise at all. And they have a current flowing. Furthermore, they don't have any loss. They don't lose their momentum with time. But they are at a finite temperature. So there's something very different about a system like that from any other system that we've worked with. You can think, well, we know enough about superconductors now to know that the electrons which make up this collective coherent state do get jostled around by thermal fluctuations. And what that does is every once in a while it throws an electron out of the coherent state, so it's no longer a member of the club. And then gradually it'll come back and another one will get thrown out. And so there's always a population of electrons which aren't partaking of the collective wave function. There's a random collection of electrons around. But the coherent state persists in spite of the fact that electrons come and electrons go. So that's a sort of a self-healing thing. If you take one more step, you can say, gee, isn't that an error-correcting mechanism? So the electrons weren't little bullets carrying charge. The electron really, when you let it be what it wants to be, is this wave thing. And how do you ever really see that? Well, we thought for many years that the way you saw deeper and deeper into physics was you hit things harder. And, of course, it turned out the harder you hit things, the more shards you find. And if they give you a Nobel Prize for every new kind of shard, people get really good at breaking things up. And so those things were called, quote, fundamental particles. These were the shards you make when you take higher and higher energy things and bash them into other things, and you get shards coming out the other side. Well, if that's the behavior you reward, you can build a whole field on that. And in fact, physics got built on that picture for all these years. Now, the theory that we have called the quantum theory is built on that picture. For that reason, the theory has never once predicted any of these coherent collective effects. I have a list of them in the little green book. We know a lot of them by now, and every one of them has been a surprise. The laser is a beautiful example. Started out as a thing called the maser. Charlie Towns had this idea that if you could get atoms excited in a certain way, that you could get a collective oscillation going in a group of them and make a very coherent kind of a state coupled by the electromagnetic field, either in a cavity or in a waveguide or whatever. He went to Bohr, one of the principal architects of our modern quantum theory. Bohr said, no, no, sonny, you just don't understand how the quantum theory works. Well, Charlie was smart enough not to listen to Bohr. So he he went off and did the experiments, and he got them working. That was a thing called a maser. And so by the time he went to talk to von Neumann, who has given us the modern form of quantum mechanics, all based on Hilbert spaces and postulates and stuff, he knew that it worked. So he asked von Neumann about it, and von Neumann said, oh, it can't possibly work. And Charlie said, well, but I have these results. And so von Neumann said, this is, by the way, the same von Neumann that did the sort of the computer architecture that we're still living with. He said, let me think about it overnight. So he came back the next day and he said, yeah, it can work. It's a lot easier to get that answer when you know what the answer is. Certainly not predicted. In fact, it was actively discouraged. Likewise, with other collective quantum effects which have come about since. In fact, let me read you a little passage that I quote here in the Green Book. The standard textbook on lasers, written by a guy by the name of Tony Siegmund, and he has just an absolutely wonderful quotation here, so let me read it to you. We have hardly mentioned photons yet in this book. Remember the picture of photons that a physicist has. A photon is a little bullet of electromagnetic energy, and when it comes along, it slams into your photodiode or whatever and makes a little blip of energy, and that's what you detect. So it's an awful lot like the raindrops. It has the same kind of shot noise. That shot noise is called photon noise. Let me just read what Tony said. We've hardly mentioned photons yet in this book. Many descriptions of laser action use a photon picture in which billiard ball-like photons travel through the laser medium. Each photon, if it strikes a lower level atom, is absorbed and causes the atom to make a jump upward. On the other hand, a photon, when it strikes an upper level atom, causes that atom to drop down to a lower level, releasing another photon in the process. Laser amplification then appears as a kind of photon avalanche process. Although this picture is not exactly incorrect, we will avoid using it to describe laser amplification and oscillation in order to focus from the beginning on the coherent nature of the stimulated transition process. The problem with the simple photon description is that it leaves out and even hides the important wave aspects of the laser interaction process. The whole stimulated transition process should be treated not as a photon process, but as a coherent wave process. So, the physics that we've been teaching our students since Bohr and Heisenberg and von Neumann has actively discouraged us from thinking in a way where we would be able to use quantum effects in this coherent, noiseless way, and has promoted the notion that, in fact, that quantization is bad because it makes these little discrete transitions, discrete packets of charge, and they make noise, and that's the problem. And, in fact, you hear people say that, you know, optical systems are photon limited. What they mean is they have this kind of square root of the number of photons come crashing into your photodiode. Well, that's not the way physics works, but it's the picture we've taught students long enough that nobody remembers how it really is, except a few engineers who never quite could pass those courses. So they tend to be the ones who invent these marvelous coherent quantum systems that have these collective properties. properties. They're lossless, noiseless, and have absolutely phenomenal properties. I want to remind you that in terms of metrology, we have three of these collective quantum devices. The laser, which is our standard of that translates length into frequency. Then we have the Josephson junction, which is another one of these collective quantum things, which translates voltage to frequency. And then we have a thing called the quantum Hall effect, which translates the ratio of voltage and current to a quantity which only involves Planck's constant and charge on the electron. So the three of our fundamental measurement technologies come from these collective quantum systems. Not one of those three devices obeys the postulates that von Neumann put forward for our, quote, quantum theory. Not one. So our quantum theory we have today has a thing in it called measurement. And let me just describe what that is. If you have a, let's say, light coming down a fiber, and you have a photodiode at the end, then that photodiode couples to the light, and it makes a measurement on that system. And in the process, it takes a quantum of energy out of the light. Wonderful experiment that my friend Ted Hensch at the institute over in Germany done an absolutely fabulous experiment. So let me just describe it to you. It's been known for maybe 10 years now that if you take an ordinary laser, what's a laser? It's an amplifying medium that has mirrors on the end so that the light is confined. And what that does, take an ordinary atom and you have two levels in it. What people call an excited state and what people call a ground state. And you put an electron in the excited state. It'll just stay there forever if it's not disturbed. But if you couple just a little bit of this lower state, the wave function of this atom, the electron in that orbit, begins to oscillate. The charge density begins to move back and forth like this. In the process, that's a little dipole that starts to radiate energy. The more it radiates energy, the energy then goes wherever it goes, and the electron gets more of the lower state and less of the upper state until finally it settles into the lower state, and that's a photon transition. But you don't have to do it that way. Let's do it with a continuous quantum system. We'll take a semiconductor like gallium, aluminum, arsenide, phosphide, or whatever, and it has two states that electrons can be in, one called the valence band and the other called the conduction band. And let's apply a voltage to that system in such a way that we populate both of those levels about half. Then what happens, because the electrons are coupled with each other, they start to oscillate. But we put mirrors on it so that the energy can't go away. So what happens is any individual electron, if you could watch them, would be going sinusoidally from the bottom state, smoothly up to the top state, down to the bottom state, up to the top state. And they're all doing this in a sort of a coherent dance. And they're all coupled together by the electromagnetic interaction. That's a perfect laser state. Now, if you start taking out some light, you have to replenish some of that energy. And you do that by you will start to draw some current to replenish the electrons in upper state. And that's how the semiconductor laser works. So that little dance that the electrons do from the lower state to the upper state and down again, that's a process that was first discovered mathematically by Schrödinger. He had given up by the time. He never did follow up on it. And it was invented later by Rabi, and it's called the Rabi oscillation. And it's well known in the laser physics community. That whole process, completely coherent process, there's no shot noise in it. There's no electrons going in like little bullets and sending out photons like little bullets. It isn't like that. It's a completely coherent, smooth process. So here we have, and they're all coupled by this completely smooth electromagnetic field. And if I want to extend that field, I can extend it arbitrarily far. Now, if at the other end of that fiber I put an incoherent thing, it'll start jangling the electromagnetic coupling all the way back into the laser. So here we have a process of generating a coherent state. The coherent state of matter coupled electromagnetically, coupled over arbitrary distances. And that's described in the it was discovered that if you put in the, between the mirrors and the laser, a what's called a saturable absorber. This is a thing which absorbs energy if the electromagnetic field is of low value. But when the light gets bright enough, it becomes transparent. And there are a number of materials that will do that. If you put something like that in there, what happens is you the laser will store up energy and store up energy and store up energy, and finally the energy gets bright enough to saturate the absorber, and then you get a pulse, and you can make femtosecond pulses that way. That was done 10, 15, maybe 20 years ago. So it's been well known, and there are these little pulses. They're cute, and you can do physics with them, and you can do chemistry with them, and it's a neat thing. Well, what my friend Ted Hench did was, he said, you know, that series of pulses coming out, if I look at it in the frequency domain, that's a comb. It's a bunch of frequencies that are around the optical frequency, but they're spaced by the time, the frequency which corresponds to the time between the pulses. So it's a bunch of channels. So what Ted did is he said, that's interesting. Supposing I took the difference in frequencies between those little frequencies, and I phase-locked them to a microwave source. He's been able to phase-lock a laser down all the way to a atomic clock. And in the process, you get something which is potentially good in terms of its frequency stability to a part in 10 to the 18th. But it's an enormous increase in coherence of our optical technology. Now, this is using radio techniques at optical frequency. In this case, it's being used for metrology. It's being used to make super high stability frequency references, higher than you could get any other way. But I would ask you to think about the potential of all of those frequencies whose phase is precisely controlled by a phase lock loop for communication system. Now, that's a coherent quantum system in the context of a communication viewpoint. You didn't do it by having some incoherent system coupled in there. It was phase locking techniques, radio techniques at optical frequencies. That's just one example of how you can think about things in a new way and get just astounding results. Now, I would submit to you that the microcosm of the future, or nanocosm, or picocosm, or atocosm, is going to be one where the real progress comes from our ability to understand in a real hands-on way coherent quantum systems. Someone asked a question yesterday about, today I guess, about quantum computing. There's no question in my mind that we will be doing things which we think of today as computation using coherent quantum systems. I think they will almost certainly not bear much resemblance to the mathematical formulations that people are calling quantum computing today. become realizable, will use these collective quantum systems. Because these collective quantum systems have built into them this self-healing, what we might call error-correcting property. To try to do that with the kind of fragile quantum systems that people are envisioning today in the papers on quantum computing, I think is hopeless. They're simply too fragile, too easily coupled to the rest of the world. The reason a superconductor stays a superconductor is that the electrons are so tightly coupled to each other that that collective effect is much larger than the random effects of thermal and other things. That's a property that we have had to work very, very hard for in our standard electronic system. And in a sense, we kind of forced it. What do? We take some transistors and we'll wire them up like a flip-flop in order for the thing to have two states, simply because the transistor itself doesn't have the property of being error-correcting, of going into one state or another and staying there. These quantum systems have that property already. The little loop of superconductor can have one flux quantum in it, or two flux quantums in it, or three flux quanta in it. It already has a natural, self-healing, error-correcting physics. That's the kind of physics that we can use to do computing. So, well, that's been known for a while. And in fact, how do you get from one flux quantum to two flux quanta? You build little Josephson junctions into the loop. The Josephson junction you can think of as just a weak point in the superconductor. So if you put a little more magnetic flux on it, it will snap, and you get one more twist in the wave function. They're fantastic things. They're the most sensitive detector of magnetic fields by zillion orders of magnitude. They're extremely, that's the amplification that's used in the Gravity Probe B satellite to detect very small shifts in the little superconducting, they're called squids. They're used to detect the position of the little gyros in the Gravity Probe B satellite. They're fantastic things. So people decided they're going to do computing with them. IBM was big into this 20 years ago. So what do? They treat them as if they were a flip-flop. They make them into a lossy digital device as if they were a silicon flip-flop. So that's an opportunity lost. An opportunity to use the real physics there in a way to do coherent computation that got hauled back into an old paradigm. Einstein had something to say about all this. I'll read you that quote, too. It's also in the little book. Concepts which have proved useful for ordering things easily assume so great an authority over us that we forget their terrestrial origin and accept them as unalterable facts. The quantum theory, for example. The road of scientific progress is frequently blocked for long periods by such errors. In other words, the thing that really, looked like it was going great guns in the last generation will be the thing that keeps us from seeing the next direction. We can count on that. So, the reason I wrote this little green book was that I wanted to get a foundation upon which to think about these coherent quantum systems. So you can think of this as the first half of the book I should have been able to write and wasn't able to. The reason I wasn't able to is because we haven't invented all that stuff yet. That's where I think electronics is going. It's where I think computing is going. It's where I think communication and computing get merged in a way that's deep, not just by kind of pasting them together, but in a very deep way. The closest we get an art form waiting to be developed there. And what's in the way of that is we've had way too much success just blindly scaling down the MOS transistor. We haven't had to really think about physics for a very long time. We let the chemists and the lithography guys do all the work. Now it's time we got busy and started thinking. And I really hope that by the 10th telecosm, we'll have a coherent quantum system doing something that doesn't just get messed up at the end by being coupled to some incoherent system. Thank
Thank you, Carver. You brought us, you gave us some heavy stuff to carry home. And this concludes this ninth telecosm, but I hope I see you all at the 10th telecosm. And thank you all for coming. And Mary, thank you for all your heroics. And thank you. Thank you, Forbes, for all your contributions for us.